This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part 3 of 3 of the interview with Dr. Ting Shen, who designs the optimal statistical and machine learning models to discover hidden patterns in data at Princeton University. And he is the founder of Finding Five, a platform for behavioral research. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs. This is going to be beyond sort of my expertise, and you can sort of teach me a lot too. Were you, are you more interested in what's referred to as, it's called frequentist statistics versus Bayesian? What kind of statistics are you interested in using to learn things about the world?
Are you sure we are going to get into this?
Well, I mean, if I don't know anything, I'll just ask. We can just do this a 5-minute version. For the people who don't like this, they're just going to tune out, and the people who do, they'll stay on.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm mostly saying this not for the podcast, but mostly this is such an existential question for a lot of people.
Right, so. Fantastic. I love existential questions.
That's right. So I personally actually don't care that much. So I'm reasonably good at both. So I during my PhD, I think I'm more of a Bayesian person, right? So I do a lot of Bayesian stats. I write up my models that are known as probabilistic generative models, right? So essentially, I would instead of perform. So the key difference is this. I should.
Yeah, thank you. Before we go down the path, so what's the difference between these two types of statistical thinking?
Yeah. Right. So, and I think this is a false dichotomy. So this is how people who love fights set up the problem.
Okay.
So here's what I think. So traditionally, frequentist statistics is used to test hypotheses, right? So you think when you talk about frequentist statistics, a lot of people usually, right? Not all the time, but usually it means null hypothesis testing to a lot of people. That means you have some data and you want to kind of test whether your theory is true, but you don't test your theory directly. You test a null version of your theory, right? You're as if you're testing something that would have been true if your theory is not true.
So I see that you have your medical training. Do you have any examples from your medical thing that would be a clinical example that people could really understand from this?
Let's see. Maybe this, right? So maybe so when I was working at a children's hospital in Philadelphia, a really important topic for pediatric healthcare is sort of childhood asthma, right? So people want to study, hey, what are the leading causes of childhood asthma? So for example, this is entirely hypothetical, right? So for example, I'm interested in whether the home environment, how much air purification device, right? So for example, if you have a furnace, what kind of filter do you have? Or do you just have air purifiers in your home, stuff like that? How does home environment affect asthma occurrence, right? So the null hypothesis here would be home environment air quality does not affect asthma occurrence, right? So you're testing your hypothesis that home air quality may affect asthma by testing it does not affect asthma.
Okay.
Right? So it's a little bit kind of an odd but reasonably odd scenario for people to work with.
So it sounds like it's a tool that has certain utility, but it also is a limited tool, and that's kind of the difference between frequentist statistics and Bayesian. It sounds like is that kind of where you're headed in this conversation?
I think what I'm trying to say is that people associate this kind of null hypothesis testing with frequentist, but it does not have with frequentist statistics. But it does not have to be a feature of frequentist statistics.
Right? I see. Okay.
So it just happens that the two different fields developed their own habits. frequentists tend to use null hypothesis testing, while Bayesian people, there's actually perfectly reasonable ways for Bayesian people to conduct null hypothesis testing as well. But the Bayesian statistics has traditionally not used it, right? So the emphasis with Bayesian statistics is on estimation instead, which arguably is more sensible.
Okay, so the focus on Bayesian statistics is estimation, but before you go down that path, can you give people a definition of Bayesian statistics?
So the Bayesian statistics, it's impossible to give a definition. Here's my view on that.
Okay.
So the Bayesian statistics, you are going to hear a lot of people say, oh, Bayesian statistics is about combining your prior belief with the likelihood, and the likelihood is the data, is the evaluation of data, right? So I have some prior belief about a certain hypothesis that I would like to test, and I collected data on that. So I now evaluated the data on the hypothesis. I combine my prior belief and the data, what the data tells me, therefore I form something that's called a posterior belief, right? So the key is the three parts, prior, likelihood, and those two combine to form my posterior.
So if we use the example used before about the home environment infecting asthma,
right?
How would that relate to a Bayesian model? Or can you give us some example that people can kind of picture?
Yeah, sure. So in the frequentist version, we just said we would start with the null hypothesis, which is home air quality does not affect asthma, right? But in the Bayesian version, we can start with an actual belief, which is maybe I want to say something like home air quality has this amount of effect on asthma.
10%, 20%, something. It doesn't matter. It has some effect, and we can assign a value
That's
to that
right.
effect. Okay.
Right. And it doesn't have to be a point. It can be a range, right? So it may have anywhere between 5% to 20%.
Okay.
Right. Something like that. And now I collected my data. So the data may tell me, oh, wow, it's more likely that home air quality has a 20% to 50% effect on asthma occurrence. So now I combine my 5% to 20% with this, what data tells me, 20% to 50%, then I get some kind of a combination. Maybe it's 15% to 35%, right? So I did the Bayesian version where I combined my prior and the likelihood, and I have now an updated belief about what the issue should be like.
Okay, so the Bayesian compares the theory with the actual data, and then you update what was the original hypothesis with new information, and the hypothesis then changes based on the new data.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you for that. So talk about during your PhD, I mean, this is maybe all you did during your PhD, is this kind of work, or was there other kind of things you were using with Bayesian models or frequentist statistical models?
Right. So let me just want to say one last sentence about the frequentist version.
Oh, of course.
My point is nothing in the frequentist paradigm that prevents you from doing the same as is that there's estimation procedure, right? So in the frequentist paradigm, you can also evaluate the data and use it to form a new belief. That's fine. It's just not how people typically do it, right? So that's why I'm saying I'm all for world peace, right? So I don't think the fight between frequentist and a Bayesian is very necessary. There are some subtle differences, but I think it really depends on how you use the tools rather than the nature of the tools.
Oh, so Ting is the peacemaker among academics in statistics.
See, that's why I'm not a true academic. Academics don't like peace.
Yeah, they want to prove their model is probably going to be right versus
That's
wrong.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, no problem. So you have these tools and you use them to try to solve problems such as weather and so forth. But I was also reading in your background that you have a little project you're doing. You don't call it a company, but kind of a nonprofit thing to help people with research. Can you tell us about that and what's that called?
Yeah, sure. So I kind of organized a group that's called Finding Five.
How do you spell that?
Just look for the stuff, right? Finding and the number five. It's one word.
Okay, finding five. Okay.
Yeah. So So the group actually, the name of that group is actually in a kind of a inside joke on the p hacking crisis, the replication crisis that we had in the psychology field. So you may know that there was a period of time that people were really worried that most psychological findings are false, right? So, and the reason for that is one of the most prominent attacks against psychological studies is that people do what's so-called p-hacking.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com.
So they manipulate their data, or maybe not data directly, but manipulate their statistical testing procedure so that they can obtain something that's called a p-value. And if the p-value it's less than 0.05, we're going to call it a day and say my finding is statistically significant.
Yeah, so the p-value is very important for people, because once you can say something is statistically significant, then you can build products or continued
That's right.
research. Or, you can build a lot of things on this, because what you're telling the world is this is very reliable research. But
right.
if what goes into saying the sentence, it's very reliable research, is not true, then you have some real problems. And that's some of the core of the replication crisis.
That's right.
And so that's why you have the finding five in your title.
Yeah, that's kind of a silly joke, right? So we know that the singular focus on finding p-values that's less than five is just idiotic. Actually, there's nothing special about a p-value that's less than 0.05, right? So there are so many nuisance points about the p-value that needs to be discussed before you can trust in the finding that comes with a p-value less than 0.5.
So the finding five might be like a geek's joke, right?
That's right. So okay. So we're saying, oh, maybe what you just want to do is find a p-value that's less than 5. Therefore, it's called a finding five.
Okay, great. So go continue. I'm sorry. I was trying to understand the finding five.
Right. So finding five, in all seriousness, it's actually an effort for behavioral researchers in general, and perhaps not even just the psychology. That we want to create a platform where people can come and just design studies that run in browsers, right? So traditionally, if you want to conduct a behavioral study where you recruit participants, you get them into the lab and you sit them in front of a computer, and the computer will display some kind of program and they will be sort of participating in that study. Traditionally, you would have to use programs like MATLAB or other kind of a SciPy, that kind of a tools to
even
program
even something like SPSS or something basic, even as basic as that, you can use.
Right. So to create this, you can use SPSS to create a study.
You can. No, I'm talking about analyzing the data. I apologize. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is really the creation of the studies themselves, right? So because you want to simulate the process of presenting a stimulus, then collect the response from that participant. Right?
Sure.
Sure. So it's the creation of the study that's usually kind of a daunting for a lot of researchers, right? So you would sometimes you would have to hire programmers to program the study for you. And other times you may learn it yourself, but it's going to take a lot of your time, right? So finding five really helps to lower the bar for people who want to create quickly create studies. We essentially came up with a grammar or programming language. But it's not really programming. It's just a set of commands, right? A set of commands that you can use. You can put into the Finding Five system that tells Finding Five, hey, I want to get a study like this and this and that, and it'll read the commands you put into the system and generate a study for you. Right.
So how does this
kind of makes the process of programming a study much, much easier than you would have to deal with MATLAB or stuff.
Okay, so this sounds like to me like something like MTurk. So just for people who don't know, MTurk is an Amazon.com product, and it helps researchers get new subjects. And so many times if you're on a campus and you're trying to find subjects for your research to test whatever phenomenon, you can find all these people on campus, but with Amazon.com's MTurk, you can actually just find random people around the world, and you can set up your parameters to say, I only want to find people in New Jersey for whatever test, and you get those people to participate in your study. Is this kind of what you're doing, or is it different in some way?
Yeah, so it's actually complementary.
So it's complementary to MTurk. Crowd workers are very much a 21st century concept, in which work is outsourced to online workers. MTurk is an Amazon service that matches work to workers such as academics and marketing companies looking for participants. These participants get paid to participate. M stands for machine, and T is named after Turk, an 18th century chess-playing automaton, a self-operating machine made by Wolfgang von Kempelen. To learn more about crowd workers and how researchers at Stanford are designing better governance and crowdsourcing, listen to my interview, episode 15, with Mark Whiting.
That's right. So the problem with MTurk is that it is a platform for recruiting participants, but it's not a platform for creating studies.
Ah, okay. Got it.
Yeah, it only has very simple templates for studies. So what Finding Five does is that we are really, it's created by researchers like us, right? So we really understand what kind of studies how behavioral studies should look like. We are not talking about question after question survey, right? So we are talking about full screen, you know, presenting stimuli and a guided experience for the participants. So it's very different from what MTurk or even Qualtrics have to offer.
Well, so that, I mean, it sounds like there's a focus on the user experience in the data collection, not just here's a screen of questions and do it.
Exactly, right. So for example, we want to make sure you answer this question first before you can proceed to the next question. We may also want to record how fast you answered the previous question, right? So these kind of aspects that we, Finding Five, is really specialized in. But I don't think the other guys are doing that.
Sure. So when we talked a little bit earlier before we started the show today, you said that some people were actually using your service to do their research. What kind of research? I mean, I don't want you to reveal anything, obviously, about those researchers or their research
right.
in particular. But what kind of things are they doing, and how are they using your service?
Yeah, so I think actually at the University of Arizona, right? So there.
Oh.
The linguistics department, a lot of researchers in the linguistics department are using Finding Five to create their, for example, language learning study. So they present some kind of a artificial language and coupled with videos to test whether participants can gradually, just by being exposed to an artificial language, so just it sounds like gibberish, but there's a pattern underlying it, right? So whether just through the course of, say, 40 minutes, can people learn a totally different language?
Just people who don't know, people use artificial languages to study language learning and behavior is because since we all come with, you know, we're sort of printed with our first and our second and our third languages, natural human languages, it's sometimes nice to create artificial languages to detect how people actually use language separated from the language they actually know. So that's what they're doing, is using artificial languages to study language acquisition patterns. And you're helping them by creating this cool experience to see how people are actually interacting with this new language.
Yeah, so, and also at Princeton, there is an undergrad, a very smart undergrad, who used the platform to study dating preferences in different racial groups.
Right?
So, she was looking at whether people prefer to date outside of their racial group or within the racial group, stuff like that.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Was she trying to find her ultimate mate? Was that her goal initially?
Well, maybe. Right, so it is a very exciting study, and I think that speaks to the effectiveness of the Finding Five platform quite well, because that undergrad, by just studying the tutorials and the documentation that we provide, she is able to code up the study just by herself, right? And I think that is really marvelous, because we have simplified the process enough so that even undergrad without much coding experience can just get started and complete a research project on her own.
Yeah, so Web 3.0, it sounds like. So
that's right.
So Ting, I just want to ask one final question. So for anyone who's thinking about doing a PhD at some point in their life, so let's say they're somewhere between 18 and 40, who knows, because some people do careers and then they come back to do PhDs later. What kind of advice would you give them before they actually make the decision to start applying, you know, and if they're accepted, that's a different set of thoughts. But what kind of advice would you give to people, anyone who's thinking about doing a PhD at some point in their lives?
Okay, I'm gonna try, but don't take the advice too seriously.
Okay. So, okay.
So I think what I have learned through my experience is that especially if you are going into the sciences, right? So things may be a little bit different if you are pursuing a PhD in the engineering field or the humanity. And I think for sciences and the humanity both, it's important not to think about how useful the PhD degree will be for you, right? So I think the PhD process, it's not about getting a useful tool out of it. It's about a sort of a improvement on yourself, right? So it's a process of learning to discover the limits of your own abilities, and maybe getting to know what you are really interested as a sort of lifelong career path, right? So if you have that kind of a mentality going into a PhD, you are much less likely to be frustrated by the outcome of the PhD.
That's important.
Right. Okay.
Because?
What's that?
You said because?
Because I think a lot of people are frustrated within the PhD process that it, at a certain point, usually around the third year or the fourth year, it seems like just impossible to put everything together required for completing a PhD. And I think that kind of mentality is, I need to get something out of it, right? But the point of a PhD is not to get something out of it, but rather to discover your own interest and yourself. So if you have that kind of a attitude towards the PhD, you are likely to be fine.
Okay.
And definitely sort of enjoy the process a little bit more.
So PhD is self-help. PhD is a long boot camp for
that's
personal
right.
discovery.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Right.
Excellent. Well, so Ting, thanks so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate your time and sharing your insights about your life, which is super fascinating, but also how you use statistics to try to solve real problems.
No problem. Thank you for having me. Hopefully I made coherent points, and it'll be useful to whoever that's listening to this, I'd be really happy.
And if they want, they could contact you through Princeton. You're findable through Princeton's website?
Yes, I'm listed on the Faculty of Journal Department of Psychology website.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Have a good afternoon.
No problem, Paige. See you there.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Ting Shen, who studies the order of things at Princeton University. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding.